You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105 FM, community radio in your city. Many thanks to Kevin Peters for the past 2 hours, but now at just past noon, it's time for Bums on Seats, the fortnightly gawp, gander and gaze at the latest cinema releases. Over the next hour, we'll be discussing which new movies are worth a second look and which should be shunned and shirked like the wretches they are. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show today are Gavin Midgley.
Hello.
Steph Smith.
Hello.
Emma Marchand.
Hi there.
And for the first time, Mike O'Brien.
Hello.
The new films under discussion over the next hour all take familiar movie tropes, dramas and locations and hope to add a fresh coat of paint. The thrill of the chase is at the heart of Ron Howard's Rush, with a rivalry between racing drivers James Hunt and Niki Lauda brought to life both off and on the track. Rome has never lacked for a camera's attention and perhaps looks even more aloof and decadent than usual, and Paolo Sorrentino's astonishingly lush The Great Beauty. Casey Affleck slips jail to be with his true love in the gloaming crime drama of Ain't Them Body Saints, and the romantic comedy falls prey to the butterfly effect in the back and forth and back again shenanigans of Richard Curtis's About Time. And with the Cambridge Film Festival now less than a week away, we have the final preview of The Rich Pickings available, this time concentrating on the short fusion screenings. Nearly 30 short films, carefully handpicked, are screening throughout the 10 days of the festival. And I spoke to Sarah McIntosh, a familiar voice from this programme, about the amazing variety of topics, styles and stories on offer when the films don't break the 30-minute mark. But we begin the show with a ready, steady go.
There's a lie that all drivers tell themselves. Death is something that happens to other people. And that's how you find the courage to get in the car in the first place. But more powerful than fear itself is the will to win.
Who's that?
It's Niki Lauda. He's just been signed by Ferrari.
The showdown between you and Niki is all anyone wants to see.
Why don't they make it safer?
The risk of death turns people on.
After another summer of superheroes knocking cities over like dominoes, a film about mere mortals racing cars seems almost prosaic. But Rush, directed by Ron Howard, depicts the halcyon days of 1970s Formula One, before the sponsors and satellite TV took over, and when the car stayed on the track less through space-age technology and more through sheer bloody-minded skill of the drivers. Written by Peter Morgan, Rush begins at the vital German Grand Prix of 1976. Austrian driver Niki Lauda, played by Daniel Brühl, is reluctantly preparing to race through impossibly wet and dangerous conditions to make sure his arch-rival, British driver James Hunt, doesn't creep closer to the title of world champion. Hunt, charismatic Chris Hemsworth, is the rock star of the racetrack, a volatile mix of devilishly handsome and devil-may-care recklessness. The German Grand Prix is just another competition in a long summer of races that have pitted the two men against each other. Whilst the season itself is merely the latest battle in a rivalry that's lasted nearly a decade. Emma, the figures of James Hunt and Niki Lauda are legendary in motor racing, and for this reason, Rush has been eagerly awaited by Formula One fans. But as a non-fan of the sport, did you manage to get caught up in this very specific drama?
I really did, which kind of surprised me, because I remember seeing the trailer and reading it and thinking, oh, I'm not sure this is really going to be for me. But I went last night and I thoroughly enjoyed this. It was a cracking 2 hours of entertainment. I think Ron Howard, and I realise looking back, I'm not a huge fan of Ron Howard films. I think this is my favourite Ron Howard film since Splash. And that's saying something, considering I was 12 when that came out, so that's why it's had such an impact on me, obviously. But no, it was, to me, it had a little bit of everything. I thought that the filming in the cars, I think, is great. And it does give you that sense that, yeah, 30 years ago, crikey, no, nearly 40 years ago, Formula One driving was properly dangerous. You know, that's not the case anymore, but there were deaths and injuries. You know, you see a lot of that in the film. I think it was shot quite attractively, interestingly. And I thought that the two lead performances were both excellent. Daniel Brewer I haven't really seen in anything since Goodbye Lenin, but I believe that he's Spanish by birth, but
he's the inquisitive, overly flirtatious German soldier in Inglourious.
Of course he is. And Chris Hemsworth obviously is known mostly for Thor, and they both give very charismatic performance. Chris Hemsworth is lucky in that he gets the flashier performance in James Hunt and does a very good job of it, because he is a very, very likeable screen presence, I think, Chris Hemsworth. So he really does, you know, gather up this charisma, this golden boy charm, this kind of bad boy, but yet very talented thing that James Hunt had going on. But Daniel Brewer is a very, very good foil to that. And I think it does keep it fairly... It sort of whizzes through the first 5 years of their rivalry and then concentrates mostly on that World Championship of 1976. And I really enjoyed it. I think it was a solid piece of Friday night entertainment. And like I said, if you're looking for a date movie, I think it is perfect, because it is going to appeal, I would imagine, to male and female. Most of the people I went into a 6 o'clock screening in Haverhill looked like, I would say, older Formula One fans. I was towards the younger end of the spectrum in there. It was a 6 o'clock screening, obviously, so early bird special maybe. But, you know, that surprised me. And I really heartily recommend it. It's corny, but I didn't think it was sentimental. The women, you could argue, are underwritten, but they're not over hysterical. I really liked it.
Gavin, this takes the normal the script by Peter Morgan, who wrote the Queen and a lot of Stephen Frears' films, and the football film from a couple of years ago. I can't remember the name of.
Damned United.
That's right. Thank you. Yeah, he's taken a very traditional biopic approach to this, almost. I would say deliberately so. We get the whole rivalry, not the whole career maybe of these drivers, but certainly the whole rivalry. That's usually an approach in biopics that leads to fairly, as Emma suggested, but though she didn't say it was a weakness, corny scenes that we'll have. It in the end, this feels a little bit like block A followed by block B, followed by block C. Is that a problem, or again, does Ron Howard find a way around this very, very traditional approach to telling real lives?
It is a problem. He doesn't really find a way around it. I mean, you're stuck because they are telling the most interesting aspect of their relationship, and you can see how it sort of fits into the natural storytelling that, you know, someone like Hollywood or a decent studio would want to fund. You know, it's got the gripping climax, so they're kind of stuck with what that story is, and they haven't really embellished it. I enjoyed it. I have to say, there was plenty of good action, as Emma was saying. There's good. The sense of the rivalry between them is good. But if you're looking for anything like character, then this really is, by the numbers, not so much Formula One as formulaic one, I would guess. I've been working on that for a long time, so as you can imagine.
And 2 years on the show build up to that moment.
That was my highlight. I can leave now, I think. Yeah, okay.
Oh, no, no, you can't.
No, I've got another stunner coming up, don't worry. It really is by the numbers, and the characters are such archetypes, and maybe they were like that. Maybe, you know, James Hunt really was this golden playboy with all the charisma and, you know, a string of women, and then you got this sort of German. He has to be German as well, of course. He's just clinical Austrian. Thank you. Yes,
that's
quite right.
Okay, because they call him the crowd at the beginning. And
yeah,
say he's actually James.
Yeah, I fell into that, didn't I? Yeah, I was brainwashed by.
I pulled you out.
Thank you. I have to stay now, don't I? To redeem myself, if nothing else. It's a So the Austrian, he's almost misanthropic. He's clinical and ruthless, and
he sees it just as a job. He says the Hunt at one point in the mid part of the film. He says to his father earlier on, "What if I'm not good at anything else?" And then he says the Hunt in the middle of the film, "This is my job. This is the only. If I could do something else, I would do that."
I was saying it's a Kirk Spock relationship here. We've got the sort of the passion, the heartfelt emotion of James Hunt versus the sort of logical clinical approach by Lauda. It's the trouble is we've seen it so many times before, and the script does nothing to embellish them further, to make it feel like a real relationship.
I've got to come in and disagree with some of that. They were. Certainly in terms of James Hunt, he was such a huge character. He was this really, really big, larger-than-life, ultra-charming personality. And I think to actually portray him as anything other than that pure archetype would do him a disservice.
But then isn't that the point? Well, this is the question I was going to come to you with anyway, Steph, is that by presenting only that veneer, you're only making a promotional advert. You get little. I wouldn't mind so much, but they have these little visual shorthands for what might be going on below James Hunt's mind. That he plays with a lighter during press conferences. That he throws up just before races, and there's suggestions, especially in Nicky Lauder's wrap up conversation at the end of the film. This was happened to James Hunt, and he stopped racing after two seasons and did something else. Suggested that just a little bit. I don't want them to dig up dirt, but just a little bit of scraping away the polish would have revealed something far more interesting than this film is interested in.
But I was quite happy that they did do that, and his relationship with his wife was explored in. Again, as I said, it was shorthand. It was done very, very briefly, very small scenes. When she leaves for New York and they have a row, that just suddenly exposed him in a different light. He suddenly wasn't this big character that was charming to everybody.
But then he goes back to being charming. He's repellent in that scene where he shouts at Olivia Wilde, his wife's character. But then he just goes back to being. You're right. He's charming in the restaurant with Olivia Wilde, his first wife, when they break up and he wants to win her back. And then he goes outside and he meets the press and he's repellent again.
Gives the most incredible soundbite, though. It's a good. I mean, that must be a real soundbite as well. And I was impressed. If anyone comes out after their wife has just said, "Yeah, I'm leaving you for Richard Burton. I'm sitting with this enormous necklace around my neck that he's bought for me," and he comes out and he gave it to that press conference.
You say he was repellent in that scene. But he was still incredibly charming. I know the way he delivered quite obnoxious statements about his wife, I thought just oozed charm. And I thought that encapsulated the character. I thought he had the mannerisms. He had, in the casting, he had the look. I think gave a very, very good portrayal of James Hunt.
I have no argument with Chris Hemsworth. I thought both leads were perfectly fine. And Chris Hemsworth, who I like his Thor as well. I find a difficult role to pull off. I think he's a charismatic actor. I just have a problem with the ridiculous dramatic shorthand of the film. That is, I find insultingly conventional, and because of its treatment builds these two men into sort of almost mythological figures, which is not a status I feel they deserve.
I did not feel they were mythological figures. I have to agree with Steph as well. It's hard for us sitting here in 2013 to remember sporting clashes like that in the 70s carried a lot more weight because now we are inundated with things to watch, things to do, ways in which to spend our time. In those days, there was three channels and very little else to do, so there were certain sporting things. It's like they did the big tennis stars of the day or whatever. These clashes, I think, did take on bigger might than they would do now because you're not diluted by all the, by having worldwide news all the time.
But then should they have done, I don't disagree with that, but then should they have done more with that? That is one of the themes, the commercialization of the sport. There's a thread at the very beginning in the first racing team that James Hunt is part of, which is basically a rich man having his lark for the first year in Formula One, and they have a news report which says they're bringing caviar and lobster to the and suddenly Formula One has a rock star glamour. There's beautiful models turning up, and Nicky Lauder in another undeveloped theme is slightly jealous of that, and that leads directly on to the final race of the season about 6 years or not 6 years but 4 or 5 years later. Two years later, none of them want to race, and they say you have to race. The TV's here, and suddenly there's a they've turned, they've created a monster. This battle between the two of them has created this monster that in the end sends them out onto the track where they don't want it. But again, it just feels underdeveloped.
I think that what you're asking from this film, Toby, will possibly take about 4 hours. You're saying all these films are underdeveloped. It is a Ron Howard film, who perhaps is not renowned. He makes crowd-pleasing, you know, he makes crowd-pleasing, big, well-made films. Well, you know, well-made.
Oh, it's very well-made. Exactly. It's visually ugly.
So it's a lot to ask, I think. I completely disagree with visually ugly.
Visually ugly, I'm going to have to go for. It's, I think, in terms of the time he spent on the film, the area you're criticising for, the character development, the drama, is probably the bit that you spent the most time on. Hardcore Formula One fans might be a little bit put off because the actual races are very much just put into very short segments.
There's actually not many races in it.
No, there's very little. It's all about the drama off track. And when the races are coming, they're shot almost music video style, very, very emotion-driven rather than technical. And I actually liked that. I used to follow F1 religiously about 10 years ago, and I was expecting something that was going to be more targeted at racers, and it wasn't. And that was actually a bit of a relief. I thought it was good to focus on the characters and not the technical aspects of the driving.
It certainly opens it out to non-fans like myself to really enjoy it.
That's fine. I'm glad there were no magic CGI shots of going inside and outside cars. I'm glad for all of that. But Gavin, does it get visually it's a weird film. It has the same, Ron Howard tackles it with the same sort of shorthand that Peter Morgan's using in the script. I'm thinking in the driving scenes at the beginning, in the normal driving scenes when they're just driving, you know, normal cars, it's rear projection, or at least it's CGI to look like rear projection, like it would be in the 1970s. And it feels like one of those films that they spent so long designing the period, making sure everybody had the right hat and the right hairstyle, it sort of drowns in that detail in the, again, like most films, in the wrong place. It could have been a lot sparser there.
There's too much shorthand for me. I mean, there's too much...
Too much shorthand, I like that.
it's cutting... Well, they don't even show some of the races. Sometimes this text suddenly appears on the screen telling you that he crashed out of this race and he burnt out of that race. And then in the final sequence, we get the commentator... The sports commentator, the worst possible narrative device for me.
For a sports biopic, that's tough.
But he over-explains everything to the audience, you know, saying, oh, Niki Lauda is a danger to himself and the other drivers on the track. You know, just to underline all the drama on the screen, just in case you hadn't picked that up as an audience member.
That's exactly what a sports commentator would say. They were after a bit of drama.
This is a film. It has to use film. This is a film with an overabundance of voiceovers already and points of view. It doesn't quite know where its story is, I would have thought. Its centre is.
But it's a Formula One film, and voiceover is key. I mean, everyone, Murray Walker is probably one of the most famous people in Formula One, and he is, you know, for his voiceover. So to be fair to it, it is a Formula One biopic, so you're going to get voiceovers in it. And for all I know, they may have been true voiceovers. Niki Lauda is still alive, after all. I don't know.
There's no way that was a real voiceover.
Well, it might have been. Sports commentators are not...
They're not exactly renowned for not hyperbole. You know, they're known for their hyperbole, perhaps, sure. Is all I'm saying. I'm really sticking up
they're
for
not
this.
The Herald Pinters of the voiceover world, but I think we've got a clash of styles here. I think there was far too much short sand. The scene in the hospital when Niki Lauda is recovering from these horrible burns he's received halfway through the film, where it's not enough that he has to be having that happen. He has to be watching TV at the same time as going through these operations to clear his lungs of blood and fluid. But if that's not enough, the TV has to be showing the races which he's missing, the two races he misses whilst he's in hospital. It's already extraordinary. The true story is already extraordinary enough that he was horrifically injured. Two races later, he returned. That's amazing.
It does a disservice to the story, I think.
Exactly.
It reduces it to this sort of soap opera melodramatic.
How do we know that did not happen?
Okay.
I'm going to write to Niki Lauda and find out. I don't know the whole... He's that obsessive.
There were stories. When he returned to racing and took his helmet off, he still had bandages on.
I'm
and
sure,
he peeled them off and he was bleeding underneath.
That's true.
It was an incredibly dramatic tale. Yeah. He returned to racing way too early for any normal person.
That's a story I really want to see.
It's the underlining of... It's the idiotic underlining of that point by having him watching those races on television whilst he's undergoing and having that drive him further on, which leads to the ridiculous scene where James Hunt, who, as we've discussed already, is a fairly repellent character, comes along and says, I'm sorry, you were horrifically injured because I was repellent, and obviously he doesn't say that, but that's basically what he's getting at. I swayed the room. I was a bully. I swayed the room for that to get Race in the Rain, and you look like this because of this. And Niki Lauda says, "Well, don't worry, you're equally responsible for me getting on the track because I saw you win those races." That's all manipulative garbage. That's simplistic garbage. And then they nod to each other like this great brotherhood of man thing. Oh, yes, okay, well, we can go back to being men. I wanted to punch the screen.
I'm going to let Steph argue because I'm not going to agree with
him. I'm getting the feeling you didn't like this much.
I did enjoy it.
Oh, it sounds like it.
You said the underlining, the idiotic underlining of these scenes. And I just think they were underlined. They were strongly underlined. And there was a massive amount of shorthand in this film. And I thought all that was to bring you back all the time to the rivalry. This was at the core of the film. This is where the film wanted to be. This is where the film spent as much time as it possibly could. And whenever it moved away from this point, either the hospital scenes or the two marriages or the team politics, it tried to get through that quite quickly with the minimum amount of dialogue so they could get back to what was at the heart of this film, which is two men who were incredibly different in outlook, who were competitors.
Okay. And both very talented. I don't know, Toby. Like I said, I think you want an awful lot from this. You seem to want an awful lot from this film, whereas, I think it delivered for me. I think it really delivers a solid piece of cinematic entertainment. I am punching my legs as I say that because I feel so strongly about it.
Okay, that doesn't really work on radio, but thank you.
That's okay. That's why I described it.
Okay, all right. Well, Rush opened yesterday, and everybody bar me, I might be going too far extreme. I was quite angry on Twitter last night. I lost followers through this. Anyway, Rush opened yesterday and is currently speeding across screens at all three Cambridge cinemas. It is a certificate 15. Cinema may well have been invented simply for documenting the wonder of Rome. The plaything of Fellini, Rossellini, Pasolini, Gregory Peck and Audrey Hepburn, the city has never been content to be simply a polite background. Even Ray Harryhausen chose to leave most of it intact when the alien attacked in 20 Million Miles to Earth. Now new release, The Great Beauty, finds director Paolo Sorrentino is equally besotted by the Eternal City, though his film is concerned with it that its inhabitants are the ones beginning to decay. The Great Beauty opens at the decadent 25th birthday party of Jeb Gambardella, played by Tony Servilla. Once a promising novelist, Jeb's life is now an endless sequence of lazy journalism, fine foods and deliberately meaningless sexual encounters, all of which he seems to survey with a wry detachment. The film, written by Sorrentino and Umberto Contolero, isn't overly concerned with plot. Rather, it follows Gambardello as he wanders the city at night. He barely dips a toe into the working city. Rather, he watches old money clash with new money, whilst nearly forgotten royalty passes the time playing cards in the shadows. He mingles with performance artists, surgeons, pornographers, playwrights and clerics, all of them hoping some of Rome's famous magic will rub off on their life. Gavin, Sorrentino's last film, his American road movie, This Must Be the Place, and his previous movies, they're wonderful to look at, but the style at times seems laughably overwrought for the subject matter. With the subject matter is Rome itself and its inhabitants, has he found a better balance between style and content this time?
I think there is plenty of both, is the easiest way to say it. There is so much going on screen. It's actually sometimes I found it a little bit difficult to see where it all's supposed to fit together. It's worth saying that the way the film is structured is it's a sort of series of vignettes, sort of mini stories going on almost within the main story, and it's not always obvious how they connect together. In that way, it's very easy to sort of follow what's going on screen. But if you're trying to get an overall sense of the story, it's not always entirely clear. It felt very impressionistic as an approach. It's sort of lots of little things going on throughout, but they don't necessarily connect. There isn't an obvious beginning and end point. It's sort of it's a snapshot, I guess, of life in Rome today for a certain strata of society, sort of modern Roman decadence as it is. And it feels, I mean, a lot has been made in its comparison to Fellini films and things like the Dolce Vita. And it does feel like a spiritual successor to that sort of film, that sort of satire of that, a form of life, a form of living, you know, the expense of living, the incredible extravagance of some of these people. So it's this sort of weird mashup of satire and almost affection for this way of life, and particularly the city. You're never quite sure what he's saying with it, where it's supposed to be going, but isn't it fabulous just to watch it? I really enjoyed it. What you can make of it, I'm not quite sure, but it's a great watch.
Mike Gavin made the reference, and was obviously not the only one, to Fellini, especially the Dolce Vita, but it doesn't have, deliberately so, I think, it doesn't have that, the joy in the visuals that Fellini has. And this is Rome, but this is a hollowed out Rome, I felt. This is by the end of it, thematically, quite a bleak film in some respects.
I didn't find that. I thought that it does have a joy in it. I mean, it luxuriates in the imagery. It just loves Rome. It just it's fantastic photography. I think the problem with the Fellini angle is everyone picks on the Dolce Vita, as most critics have, and I don't think that's the key to it. I think it's Fellini's 8.5 that's more pertinent to this, because as much as it's about the decadent Rome, the actual great beauty that he's seeking is something that the character that Tony Servillo plays brilliantly is seeking, that he can never find in his life. And he thought he captured it in his first book, but he didn't. And so the film is much like 8.5, like a series of vignettes that Gavin said, but it's more about, I think, his internal struggle with the state that he's become. And the society is like a proxy for his state of mind and his almost self-loathing of what he's become, but the process by which he begins to see a way out of this. And that's what I think the film ends on. I think it's got problems, but I don't think it's a hollowed out Rome. I think that's partly about himself being hollowed out.
Well, Italy being hollowed out. I think that's the reason why I see it is not overly bleak. Bleak is not what you're thinking when you're watching it, because it is so amazing, stunning to look at. But where the Italian cinema, which it most obviously echoes, the Italian cinema of the late 50s or early 60s, where it was extravagance that seemed to shout from the rooftops, this seems to be much emptier extravagance. This seems to be, Italy's still beautiful, but nothing's happening. Our lead is 65, and all the other characters are roughly the sort of that same age. Anybody younger is pretty much portrayed as fairly empty. The new money that's moving in and doesn't have any, they don't do anything. We have reality TV stars who don't do anything. This is a beautiful shell of a city. That's what I got across it, and that's Italy now. That's the, at least where the characters, like the ones that of our hero, they're liberal, they're left leaning, they've been complacent during the Berlusconi years, and this is, if you take Rome as Italy large, this is the country you've been left with, a beautiful shell of a place. And that's why I found the end result bleak. I didn't think it was, because in the end he's never going to write another book, and he's never going to do anything, and he knows that. He's not after the journey looking for the great beauty is where he's going to end up, never, because he doesn't want actually to find something. It's the laziness of the journey of looking.
He's been sort of lulled into that laziness.
Yes, exactly. He thought he was still looking, and then he realises, no, I'm not still looking. Or rather, I'm not looking to find any longer.
Yeah, I agree with you that emptiness in the society around him, and in my opinion, is reflected in what he feels about himself, what he's become. I think there is an optimism at the end of the film that he is going to now try and write the book. And I think he has, because he's learnt from what's happened, from a particular plot point that something about his past comes to haunt him again, that he begins to learn something about putting this great beauty that he's looking in some realistic content. So I see that there's hope at it at the end of the film. But yes, it is extremely bleak about the society around him. And I think just say about the style as well. I think the style, it's a lot about Fellini, but he has the director has, I think, has honed a style that I don't usually particularly like, this kind of flamboyant camera work. But I think he kind of makes it work in this.
Does he go over the top? It is fantastic, but he goes, there's a party scene at the very beginning. There's two amazing scenes at the beginning.
It's a wonderful scene.
There's the fountain scene where the camera keeps moving and he keeps cutting during the camera moves at odd times, and the grammar's rather odd. Then he goes to the party scene, and I didn't like the party scene very often much, actually, because I thought the editing in it was lazy. I think it's deliberately lazy after the scene preceding it. But there's one scene where we get the shot of the exotic, erotic dancer in the glass box that all parties have, I'm sure.
Yes.
And then he cuts, so we see her gyrating, and then we cut to inside the box, and obviously the music's cut muted completely, so we just hear the creak of this uncomfortable corset. That sums up the whole film. That one cut sums up the whole film. Beautiful on the outside, creaking and awkward, the reality of it.
Yes.
But he keeps making the same point over and over and over again because it looks pretty. And I felt that undermined it. He kept occasionally slipping in the Terry Gilliam-esque silliness or magic realism that didn't quite work. You didn't need a CGI giraffe at the end. You didn't need.
Well, I love the CGI giraffe. Giraffes, I thought it was fantastic.
Giraffes are some of the politest animals. Why is it CGI? Surely you could have got a giraffe to stand in a green screen
room. Well,
it looked
pretty convincing to me. So I wouldn't go with that.
Bowtie gave it away, Mike.
And I thought that the party scene was brilliantly edited. I loved the editing in that style. And I look on this film as like a piece of music, and that it has to have that length of time and that lovely insert of the girl, and you go back. Inside as a sort of dip in the music, if you like. I think that works brilliantly, and it's all very well constructed that way. But it brings me to think, I do think my point that hasn't really been brought up from what I've seen is some of the treatment of women is really sort of it's going back decades, and the end revelation of his at the end of the film, there's a supposedly wonderful moment. The way it's done is so. Distasteful. Thank you.
There's a thematic simplicity there. Again, I've only got three words, Emma. I just throw them around for every film. Thematic simplicity, underlined, highlighted.
Sure.
Which again is what I find. I like this film a great deal, but it kept bothering me that, like, This Must Be the Place and some of his other films, there wasn't a huge amount going on underneath the hood. It felt like there was. There's a sort of link with performance art and religion.
Oh, yeah.
That felt a bit lazy. There's a sort of idea about age with Nun, who's now about 100, and everybody else who refuses to accept age. And I'm not sure those points went anywhere. They were just thematic window dressing rather than simply to go with the Baroque window dressing of the visuals.
Well, that's a lovely theme, that little theme with the living saint with her little legs dangling in the chair and that beautiful image at the end of trying to climb these stairs. Oh, no, I thought that was a lovely vignette in the film. Yes, he does go into excess, but that's kind of what it's telling about. But I think he's got to start. I mean, I think actually this is probably not his best example of the style. It's an earlier film, The Consequences of Love, where the style of camera work was perfectly matched to his internal process. But I think this, again, it does reflect not just about the society. I think that misses a point. It's about his internal journey. And when you get that, then these things become much more, they fit more into place. I do think it's probably too long, but hell, it's a great film to sit back and enjoy.
Okay, all right, we'll end it there, or else we've already taken up half the show with two films. Typical. All right, The Great Beauty opened last week and is still screening the Arts Picture House Certificate 15. We all heartily recommend it.
You're online, so are we. Search for Cambridge 105 on Facebook and Twitter, or follow the links from our website, cambridge105.fm.
Keep up to date with all the latest sporting action on 105 Sport every Saturday afternoon from 4. Join me, Chris Stewarden, and the rest of the 105 Sports team for latest news, conference and Premier League goals as they go in, special features on local sports clubs, and plenty of controversial insight and opinion on the previous 7 days in world sport. Plus, throughout the football season, we'll be broadcasting live from the Arkostings Abbey Stadium for all of Cambridge United's Saturday home games. We'll have fans forums, player interviews, post-match reports, and, of course, live second-half commentary on the U's throughout the season. What a goal from Cummington in the first minute. That's 105 Sport, live from 4 till 6pm every Saturday, right here on Cambridge 105.
Did you know you can download a selection of Cambridge 105 shows as a podcast? Get downloading now at cambridge105.fm.
You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 FM, community radio in your city. The 33rd Cambridge Film Festival begins in just a few days, on the 19th of September. Whilst attention will be focused on the UK premieres and speaking guests, as always, it's the smaller movies to keep an extra vigilant eye on. This year, once again, some of the most interesting films may be found in the short fusion screenings dotted about the programme. These are the short films. They number just about 30, carefully whittled down from over 400 submissions, and they are lined up in themed programmes designed to intrigue and reward. Life Distorted, Love and Loss, Growing Pain, Existential and Nostalgia. To find out more about the film showing, I spoke to Sarah McIntosh, a regular reviewer for this programme and this year in charge of the festival's submissions as well as the short fusion strand. I asked Sarah if short films were still best seen on the big screen and why the festival was, this year, spreading the screenings around the schedule a bit. But I began by asking what drew her to the short film format.
Do you ever get the feeling that we're all turning into the same person?
Good morning. My name is Michael Morgan and I...
I know who you are. You were just here.
Did I look very much like me?
I think because it's just fascinating, as someone who's actually made films myself, to find all the elements that you would find in a feature film, but have such a limitation on to the amount of time that you can use to tell the story, to create the atmosphere. It's a very underrated form for that reason, because that kind of limitation, I think it's almost a more courageous thing than making a feature film.
Is there a marked difference between the filmmakers who wanted to make a short film, a glimpse into something, a window into a life rather than the whole life, and those that you felt were just making a short film as a gateway to making something else, or as an experiment to show off a technique, and it didn't have the best interests of the form in mind?
There were a few films, and a few in particular sort of enter my mind as you were talking, that you could kind of see that what they wanted to do was a feature film, and it was kind of just a starting point or like a teaser, a trailer almost for making that. What I think then happens is that there's no real satisfying conclusion to the film. It sort of peters out and loses any impact that it had. So I think when you're looking for a good short film to put into a festival, at least from my perspective, I'm looking for something that offers those things that a feature film would give you when you go and visit the cinema, and to be complete in itself.
Could you mention a little bit about the five themes that the films are broken into?
We've got existential, growing pain, love and loss, nostalgia and life distorted. Putting them together was kind of an interesting thing. I'd never really done that before, and it was kind of more a sense of how to fit such diverse films together, and I basically just used sort of intuition. But it was also about trying to find connections between the films. So we've got Life Distorted. I'd say it's got sort of a Jeunet feel about it, a Jean-Pierre Jeunet feel. Love and Loss looks at the importance of love, but also the importance of loss within how we grow and how we change, and sometimes for the better, sometimes not, but how it affects us as individuals, as human beings. Growing Pain, the S is missing. That's very important to me, because all the films in that one have something to say about transitions in life. We also have Existential, that again ties in with looking at what it means to be human. And then the last one is Nostalgia, looking at history, but not just real history. So there's a couple of documentary sort of things in there, but also looking at imagined history, how we perceive the past.
Are there any films in the programme where they're a bit rough around the edges and they may not have gone into other programmes, but you could see there was still a spark there that needed to be encouraged, that needed to be seen?
It's about coherence. There are at least a couple of films which I would say they aren't the bigger budget short films, but there's something definitely there. And one in particular is a film called Hitching the A1, which is in our existential strand.
London, the largest city in the world, has a splendid road service of passenger buses for the millions of people needing quick and comfortable transport from place to place.
My name's Gary McQuiggin, and my film is called Hitching the A1. It's a short film about a journey me and a fellow filmmaker, Onyeka Igwe, made up the longest road in Britain, the A1 from London to Edinburgh. It was about making a road trip, and there's no longer road trip than the A1 in Britain if you're going in a straight line. It's nicknamed the backbone of Britain by some people. I thought it would be an interesting way to kind of to look at the country via this route that takes in a lot of different landscapes, a lot of different psyches, a lot of different places. I just thought it'd be interesting to thrust myself into it and see what I find.
The style is so deliberate and careful. Was this feeling of something having been lost? Was that something you were aware of when you started on the journey, or something that seemed to come into place as you were on the journey itself?
It was definitely something that I picked up on the way, so to speak. Anyone I spoke to about hitchhiking spoke about it in the past tense. I mean, I mention in the film that it's something of dying art, which is, you know, was the impression I got before doing it. And I always wanted the film to have a kind of melancholy tone to it. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I would say a lot of the selections that I made resonated particularly with things that I approached the project with. So, for example, there's a man who says there's a romance to driving, and I definitely felt that that was something that I thought would come up. And, you know, I definitely wanted there to be a kind of romance to the film.
What sort of life has the film had since you made it?
The film premiered, so to speak, at a film festival that the British Film Institute run. I've been submitting it since February, when I kind of decided it was finished. And it's had a screening on the community channel. But it's also, I also put it online in June, just because it kind of feels like you're sitting, you know, you're kind of sitting on it for a long time if you're waiting for festivals to kind of approve it. Or, you know, I kind of feel I want people to watch it rather than I want, you know, kind of film festival crowds to watch it. I want anyone to watch it, you know.
The answer lies in Welland Garden City.
I'm getting less precious, I think, about where you see films. And I think the internet has its role. But yes, I would agree that I think it's also important to have other ways of seeing. And the cinematic experience, whether it's a short or whether it's a feature, is important because it's a communal experience. And that changes the way you view the film. That changes the way you interact with the film. That, in turn, changes the film itself.
Could you talk a little bit about the film that's outside all the strands, Just Before Losing Everything, and why that's outside all of the strands?
Just Before Losing Everything, it's sitting outside the strands because it's so impactful. Before I went to the Cannes Film Festival, I went to the Clermont-Ferrand website, which Clermont-Ferrand is known to be sort of the biggest and most reputable short film festival in the world. And I thought, well, you know, it would be good to go with a bit of an idea of some things to look out for. One of those things was the Grand Jury Prize winner, Avant que de tout perdre. When I saw it, I think of all the short films that I've seen, and I've seen many, and you know, a vast majority of them are just fantastic. But this film in particular sort of really blew me away in the fact that I found myself holding my breath, and it really struck home to me the sort of temporal prejudice that exists in regard to short film, and the fact that, you know, here's this film 30 minutes long and I'm having such a visceral reaction to it. There's something important, something to be said about why we sideline short film so much, but then also, you know, that this film in particular I think I sort of see it as a way to get people in. Hopefully people will have a similar reaction to what I had, and then that might open up their minds to be able to, you know, watch other short films.
This year the screenings seem to be a little bit more audience friendly in the timings. Usually they've been shuttled away a little bit into the late night, and whilst there are some post 11 p.m. screenings here, there are more at 5:30, there are some at the morning.
Yes, I think it was a very conscious decision after last year to make them more accessible. Growing Pain is actually showing one session is at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and that is because there's going to be a school visit to that one, and you know there's things that have been taken into consideration about making them accessible not just to late night audiences but to maybe family audiences or younger audiences as well. Creating these short programs has been just so much an education for me in regards to short film, and I feel very proud of every film that's in the short strand. I feel a bit protective of them as well.
Many thanks to Sarah for dashing into the Arts Picture House for the interview, and to Gary McGuigan, director of Hitching the A1, for later joining me over Skype to talk about his film. The short fusion screenings begin on the first day of the festival, Thursday the 19th at 5 p.m, with a Life Distorted theme, which is also repeated on Saturday the 28th. Hitching the A1 is part of the Existential Strand and is screening this Friday the 20th at 11 a.m. You can find out more from page 75 onwards of the festival guide.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me are reviewers Emma Marchant, Gavin Midgley, Steph Smith and Mike O'Brien. Sorry, Steph. Straight after us at 1 p.m. will be the music and chat of Saturday lunch, whilst at 2 p.m. will be the latest R Mill Road, which has moved from its Sunday slot to Saturday afternoons. At 3 p.m. it's Radio Dante, and then between 4 and 6 the station puts on its football boots for coverage from the Cambridge United versus Gateshead game. We'll wrap up this Bums on Seats with a look at the timey-wimey romance of About Time, but before that, we're heading down Texas way.
Ruth, I dreamed about you again last night. I hold your face in my mind. I think about your hair getting longer. I think about your belly getting bigger. I think about our baby girl.
You take those girls and you got trouble.
Maybe you get out of town till all this blows over.
You mean till he gets caught?
Have you seen him?
Sure haven't.
We can make it. We can make it if we run.
Every day I wake up thinking today's the day I'm going to see you. And one of those days, it will be so. And then we can ride off to somewhere. Somewhere far away.
Ain't Them Body Saints is set in the seemingly perpetual gloaming of 1970s Texas. The film stars Casey Affleck as Bob Muldoon and Rooney Mara as his wife Ruth Guthrie. Pinned down by the law after an armed robbery, they decide to go out in a blaze of glory, but end up captured after only shooting and injuring one cop, played by a surprisingly gentle Ben Foster. Though Guthrie fired the guilty shot, Muldoon takes the fall for her, ending up with a lengthy prison sentence as his pregnant partner pleads coercion and goes free. 4 years later, Muldoon escapes and instantly sets out to track down his wife and the daughter he has never seen. Mike, obviously we don't have very long on this, sorry, but Ain't Them Body Saints is a familiar story told in a familiar fashion, but there's David Lowery, and this is his debut as writer and director, and he's an editor beforehand. He edited Upstream Colour. Does he find enough angles to make this story seem fresh?
For me, it does. I mean, it's not a perfect film, but it's got some flaws. But for me, it was an intriguing film, so I came out of it wanting to see it again. So that's always a good sign. The comparison, a bit like the Great Beauty and Fellini, the comparison's always made with Malick on this film, and there is a huge debt to this. Also, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, perhaps, but. It works, I think, because it kind of takes... the director talks about archetypes and And he talks about it being a folklore and an old ballad and that. So he's taking these myths and archetypes and he's looking at them and he kind of critiques them. And what's interesting is the character of that Affleck plays kind of wants to believe this myth. And part of his character is always seeking to be the romantic outlaw.
He thinks he's the hero in his own story, and exactly. He's not. He's an inconsequential villain,
yes,
a minor villain, and who's been forgotten in the short time he was in jail.
And I think that's done really well. He's superb acting. But what's really interesting in this film is about the his partner in this, who plays the girl. I can't remember.
Rooney Mara.
Rooney Mara. She is just fantastic. She's got a really hard part to play because we never quite know what her internal thinking is. It's always implied, and there could be two very different reasons why she's doing things, but she plays it to perfection so that you really are intrigued by her. I mean, there are strong performances throughout this film. Just to watch it for the performances is enough, I think, just to go and watch it. So I think yes, it does have a fresh angle because this self-referential angle kind of makes you re-look at what you've seen before on the screen and see it in a fresh light.
Okay, just one final point. I felt it was a little bit like they were wading through rather than took the carrot. I felt it was unnecessarily referential to the Malick model without actually understanding the Malick model. There's lots of POV shots or rather cameras following people that Malick used to do. There's voiceover, but it's constantly misused voiceover, and there's lots of non-linear editing, but it's misused, and I felt it didn't add anything. And if the characters were wading through a film rather than they found themselves in this film and they were wading through the villain arrives in the same town as his wife a good way into the film and then doesn't go to visit her, and I don't know what's holding that meeting up. He's meeting everybody else. What's holding that up? It just, everything seems to be moving as if they're set to clockwork, and it doesn't feel real, but it doesn't feel unreal enough to warrant this slowness.
Yeah, I can see a lot of people picked up on the plotting of this film. I think it's partly deliberately and partly because it's his first film. There are ambiguities in the plotting, yes. But I kind of like a lot of the things. Most of the things are not really fully explained, and I love that because I think far too many films explain too much, and I'd rather have the mystery and we don't need to be told everything. I think it works far better, and I think in the main it works in this film and keeps you intrigued by these characters.
Ambiguity is always good, I find. Ain't Them Body Saints opened last week and is still screening at the Arts Picture House for the next week at occasional screenings, as well as two dates as part of the Young American season during the Cambridge Film Festival. It is, like everything else, a Certificate 15. The world is a Certificate 15. The faltering first steps of love are so littered with wrong turns, ill-timed gestures and instantly regretted moments that it's surprising that time travel and romance aren't more common bedfellows. About Time, the latest romantic comedy from writer-director Richard Curtis, redresses the balance somewhat, finding him gleefully mixing his customary awkward flirtations with a looping timey-wimey disregard for the time-space continuum. Domhnall Gleeson, Brendan Gleeson's son, plays Tim, a loose-limbed young man with a bohemian upbringing on the Cornish coast that's ill-prepared him for the world of big business and having to talk to women. On his 21st birthday, his father, a typically eccentric Bill Nighy, tells him that, like all the men in his family, he can travel back in time. He need only ball his fists, stand in a dark room and think of a point in his own past to zip back to. At first, Tim uses his strange skill only flippantly, but the time hopping comes into its own when he meets a beautiful American played by Rachel McAdams. Steph, come straight to you, skip the trailer. About Time has been greeted as a typical Richard Curtis film, seemingly beloved by audience. I saw it in a very full, very happy Arts Picture House, but torn asunder by critics. They've been very, very mean about this. Are the dissenting voices merely joyless, or is this Curtis lazily recycling old plots and characters yet again?
Well, a lot of the critics have been talking about other films. They've been comparing it to The Time Traveller's Wife or to Groundhog Day, and I think these comparisons are completely wrong to make. It's a very, very different film to those two. Whereas the comparisons that you're drawing there, bringing it back to Richard Curtis and his other writings, I think is completely justified. It feels like every other film he has either written or directed is a remake of Four Weddings and a Funeral. He goes back to the same emotional journey where he starts off with a character that bumbles through their life without any real purpose, finds some happiness, finds some sadness, learns a couple of lessons and grows a little bit by the end. And I felt it was another film that was very much on that formula again. The time travel was a fairly underused plot device that just led the character on that journey.
Emma, is that necessarily a bad thing, that repetition? I was thinking when, this is a slight tangent, but I was thinking when the critics were going, oh, it's another upper-class family, it's another rich people. That doesn't matter. All of Lubitsch's films, which are rightly regarded as masterpieces, feature upper-class families. That doesn't matter, but there is a laziness here.
It's not even about laziness. It's the fact that every film he makes, it goes to ever-decreasing. It's in ever-decreasing circles. So Four Weddings and a Funeral is great, and the characters in it are great. The fact that they wouldn't really be ever friends in real life doesn't matter so much because it was fresh and original and we hadn't seen it before. For example, that Scarlet character from Four Weddings and a Funeral, Charlotte Coleman, love it. Then it becomes the Honey character in Notting Hill, which, you know, is a film, again, where you have this, you know, you've got someone who's posh and a bit dim, you've got bumbling Hugh Grant, you have the scatty friend who's the Honey character in that one. That now becomes this sister, Kit Kat, in this film, and she annoyed me more than anything else because I wasn't sure if she was meant to have slight mental problems, alcoholism, or just issues with men. It seemed it could have been any of those things, and I just think the women, if you want to talk about badly written female characters, go and see Richard Curtis because he cannot seem to write a realistic female character to save his life. This film is saved for me by Bill Nighy because he's being Bill Nighy and you can't ever hate Bill Nighy, and the performances of Donald Gleeson and Rachel McAdams. She's charming enough to get away with it, but my God, I didn't laugh. And one last thing, I'm sorry Steph, I'm just going to say as well, any film that starts off with Bill Nighy explaining time travel to Donald Gleeson and Donald Gleeson going, great, I'm going to use it to go make myself lots of money, and Bill Nighy saying, oh no, I've never seen a truly happy rich person, how can he say that when they're living in a palatial mansion on the Cornish coast, none of them seem to have to work, and they just spent all day playing tennis in a glorious summer. I don't mind the fact that Richard Curtis sets everything in, as people call it, Richard Curtis land, upper class London, but at least have some sense of self referential about it. Don't expect us all to sit there and just accept that. And there are even comments in there like, oh, and then we had to move to a house we couldn't really afford. Really? The charm loses on it. It's lost every time he's made another film because he just seems to get stuck in that. I'm sorry, Steph, go on.
Gotta say, I don't want to go that harsh on it. I rather liked it. I left the film despite the overused narration throughout the film, the voiceovers, and the heavy-handed approach to it. I left it feeling quite buoyed up by it. It did work, but I was hoping for a little bit more. And thinking about it afterwards, I looked at the character and thought the only life lessons that that Tim learns throughout the film are, I think every single one is directly imparted by him talking to his dad. Bill Nighy tells him everything that he learns in that film, and there's nothing he learns by himself. And that left me thinking, it's not his film. I want to see the film about Bill Nighy's character. I want to see him learning all those lessons for the first time and not telling his son about them.
Can I say, I know you're going to come to Gavin, I just want to say this. I agree with you. All they do is throw the most common emotional thing we all have. We all have parents, and lots of us have children, and that is the only emotional... And it yes, it works because the acting is okay, and it hits some emotional buttons for sure, but it is so lazy, and the time travel, it's like it was a good idea and he does nothing around it other than, like I say, just throw something on there. We can all understand. We can all understand the emotions around parents and children, but it's not enough just to stick that on a screen and say, there's your film, which is what I felt he did.
Gavin, do you want to move in to defend?
I'm going to try and say something. I don't. This.
There are
lots of valid points. There are lots of valid points. All I would say is they all worked for me. I actually felt this is one of his stronger films because it explores some areas. He was willing to go outside of some of his usual boundaries. The thing that really worked for me was the fact that the trailer completely missold this film. I went in expecting another boy meets girl rom com, and that start part of the story is over within the first 20 minutes or so. And the time travel, as Steph said, is almost becomes a background thing by the end. He's much more interested in the sort of family setup and the relationships that are going on between them.
He's interested in one relationship and the family setup and nobody else
in
the family.
Lindsay Duncan is the most underwritten character I've seen in a film this week. His mother gets completely dissed from the very beginning. He just says, yeah, she's lumpen. I'm like, that's Lindsay Duncan.
The focus is on the father relationship, sure. And that's,
but
there are other relationships in orbit around that, which he's also willing to look at. And it's, and the, so the, you know, so the time travel device becomes a bit sort of, you know, life lesson-y, banal, you know, learning. It's in much the same way that Groundhog Day did. You know, he learns, even with all the time in the world, you know, that there is a better way of living life than being horrible or ignoring the people around you. There are those parts of the plot worked really well for me. All I can say is, I mean, maybe the children aspects of the story didn't work. I don't know. I don't have children. But the parental side of the relationships in the story worked really well for me. And the sister relationship, the sister character didn't annoy me at all. In fact, I found it one of the more interesting parts of the story.
All right, we haven't got time to go back to Emma. I wish we did, and I haven't even had a say. Anyway. Okay, About Time opened last week and is screening at all three Cambridge cinemas, two full houses. It is a certificate 15. And that is all we have time for on the show today. The whole shebang will shortly be available as a Cambridge 105 podcast, available to download or to stream from www.cambridge105.fm. Rather than our customary fortnight away, we'll be back in only a week's time on the 21st of September with the first of our two film festival specials. As always, we'll be trying to throw light on some of the smaller films with reviews of Hawking, Prince, Avalanche, Mushrooming and the Lebanese Rocket Society. Please stay tuned for Saturday Lunch. We're going to play out with a little bit of Bollywood to remind you of Bollywood, the greatest love story ever told, which is screening Friday the 20th and on Sunday the 22nd as part of the festival's music strand. Stay tuned for Saturday Lunch, but everybody on Bums on Seats, goodbye.